Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How might outcomes change in the developing world if we switch the focus for aid efforts from top down to grassroots? My guest today has seen firsthand how so-called venture philanthropy can help people in need, in part by acting as a liaison between large-scale funders and small-scale service organizations, which might be transformed by an investment of just a few thousand dollars a year. But she also believes it is critical to ask the customers of those organizations about how they are performing before committing even small sums of money. And that informs the way she runs the Global Fund for Children, of which she is founder and president. Maya Ajmera is in town for an address tonight at 6 to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. The event takes place at the Rosewood Crescent Hotel in Dallas. You can learn more at dfwworld.org. Maya, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
I want to start by talking, and I know it's a story you've told before, but about this epiphany that you had that really changed sort of the course of your life. Will you talk about that?
Sure. I was brought up in Eastern North Carolina, the daughter of Indian immigrants, and had a very interesting growing up experience growing up in the South, but also spending my summers in India. And that sort of brought me as a global citizen. And my father is a physicist, so we would go to some other countries for conferences. And I was one of those typical Asian kids that was supposed to become a doctor. And I went off to college up north and majored in neuroscience and thought my destiny was to go to medical school. I was very lucky that I got a fellowship that allowed me to travel to South and Southeast Asia. And I had some wonderful faculty members part of the program that said, if you really want to know people and understand the way they live, get your backpack and go travel throughout the countries. And I went to India, Pakistan, Nepal, Burma, which is now Myanmar, Laos, Thailand, Vietnam. And I say that during one of my pieces of my travel in India, I had a moment of obligation. And I was at a train station in India, and if you've been to India or any train station in the world, they're dynamic places.
Sea of humanity.
Yes, yes, lots of people, trains. But in India, one of the things you see is a lot of children. And I came off a train station in Bhubaneswar, India, and it was a very hot, dusty day in March. And I got off this train, and I started walking, and there I saw 50 children sitting in a circle learning how to read and write. And this incredible teacher in the middle teaching them with flashcards. And the children were obviously poor and destitute. And I asked the teacher, because I speak Hindi, and she spoke the local language called Oriya, but we were able to communicate somehow. And she told me that these children lived on the train platform. They worked, they played, they begged, they slept, but they didn't go to school. So a teacher in that city said instead of bringing these kids to school, she was going to bring the school to the train platform. And what she created for 50 children was this isle of magic. And for 4 hours a day, they would learn how to read and write, get human rights awareness, like learning where the police station is, where the hospital is if they get hurt. And on Saturdays, they would get a hot bath. And every day, they would get a hot, nutritious meal. And I said, well, how much does it cost to run one of these schools? And she said, in rupees, but I converted it, it was about $400 a year.
For 50 children?
50 children, two teachers for the whole year. And it was there that I had the moment of obligation. Not knowing anything about foreign aid, the World Bank, USAID, I thought, how do you get small amounts of capital to the most worthy grassroots organizations, to social innovators that are really providing change to the poorest children in their communities? And how a small amount of money can make a big difference if put in the right hands. So I had that sort of vision in my head, and I was thinking of going to Duke Medical School, but I circumvented it and went to the public policy program, the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke. And it was there that I learned about the World Bank and USAID and the big aid we've been providing. And I started thinking in the mid-1990s that we have to do this differently. what does it mean for us to put small amounts of capital into the hands of people and have deep empathetic trust and invest in them and their dreams and let them scale their work? So that one trained platform school I saw in 1994 now has 25 trained platform schools and has replicated their work throughout India. That has a great leverage effect, but also great sustainability.
What I love about that story is that extraordinary optimism and that sense of omnipotence that we have in our early to mid-20s.
Hallucinogenic optimism is what I call it.
It can get things done. I wonder if you can talk about what made you decide after investigating things that it would work better to sort of start your own organization, international organization, as opposed to hooking up with an established group and saying, I'm going to make change from within.
Well, interestingly, we were a very small cohort in the early mid-1990s thinking about this work. I was probably one of the only ones thinking about grassroots investments to social innovators in the early to mid-1990s. There's another group called Ashoka that funds social entrepreneurs,
sure,
the person. And there's Global Fund for Women that funds women in human rights groups. But there wasn't anything focused on grassroots and children. And I thought, that's a niche for us. But there was one other piece of caveat to it, is you just didn't want to give funds for a year and walk away. You wanted to be a partner with them during the good and the bad times and help them grow and help them become sustainable and really invest in long-term social change, is what I say. And I thought there was a niche for us. The other piece of our work was, growing up in Eastern North Carolina, I loved reading children's books, but I never read a lot of children's books about the global world. The best I could come to was Tintin. Mm-hmm. And I thought Tintin was wrong most of the time. So I thought I wanted to create a children's book publishing venture as well that would teach children about the global village that we live in. So that was another unique creative piece to the organization. And when I put this all together at the age of 24, telling my mentor at Duke University that this is what I wanted to do, he said, that's a pretty big, hairy, audacious goal you have there. But go out and raise some money. And I went to a group, a private equity group in New York called General Atlantic, that actually has a fund for social entrepreneurs called Echoing Green. And I was part of a cohort of young social entrepreneurs that got $100,000 in seed capital to start the organization. Wendy Kopp of Teach for America was part of that. Alan Casey, Michael Brown of City Year, Vanessa Kirsch of Public Allies. There was a whole host of us that were part of this movement.
I think one thing that's really interesting about your model is the fact that although you want to be there for a matter of years and to help these organizations grow, in fact, the ultimate goal is for them to be self-sustaining.
Right. So even though we're a partner for several years, and partnership can be 3 years, it can be 8 or 9 years based on the issue that they're working on or based on where they're working. So if they're working on an issue on trafficking and child prostitution, we're going to stay with them for a long time because the funding for that sort of work is harder than a peer education program. We actually have sustainability awards. So after a certain time where we've seen them grow, where they don't need $5,000 or $10,000 from the Global Fund for Children anymore. They're getting $50,000 gifts. They're getting government support for their work to scale. We step back and we give them a sustainability award that they can use the best way they see how to build sustainability. That can be revenue generation. That can be a small corpus fund. It can be a whole host of things. So out of our 375 partners, we've actually exited 60.
That's amazing.
Exited 60. And we track the 60 still. Every year, every 2 years, we give a tracking grant of $1,000. They fill out a very easy survey for us and say, how are you doing? Even though you don't get funding from us, how are you doing? Can you imagine the knowledge after 20, 25 years of what's happened to those groups now and then in the future?
Do you ever see two separate groups that you have worked with coming together for a partnership to do something different?
Yes. what we love to do is not only are we a direct supporter of these organizations, we also provide something called value-added services. And we do three things. We leverage additional support for them. We hire independent organizational development consultants to help build their capacity. But the third thing is we actually create knowledge exchanges where we bring our partners together for a conference and put them in a room together for 4 days, and magical things happen. Most of the time, many of these leaders have never been on a plane. They've never had a professional experience like this in the nonprofit community, and they're able to exchange ideas. And then what we do is give a grant for them to go and learn at the other NGO, or they're online and they're trying to learn from each other. So we've seen quite a bit of exchanges going on.
I have to imagine when you're working with grassroots, truly grassroots organizations, there's a certain kind of creativity that the best management training in any developed country couldn't approach.
That's right. I call it innovation in what we say is innovation in times of scarcity. Mm-hmm. Well, this is innovation when it's scarce all the time, right?
Permanent scarcity.
Permanent scarcity. And my feeling on this is that the ingenuity that many of these groups have to survive and to keep doing their work will happen if GFC is there or not. A lot of them have revenue generation that they're doing. They've created an enterprise that brings in income, whether it's micro-enterprise, whether it's children learning the traditional crafts that get sold, and then the money comes back to the children and they use it to start their own small businesses. We see a lot of that. We see agricultural projects where you're growing your own food, but then you start selling it to your neighboring villages. I find all of these different ideas extraordinary. But at the end of the day, they need the support to be able to educate and provide health care and provide safety and provide a place where children can dream. I mean, ultimately, every child in this world deserves that opportunity. And I am just humbled by these leaders who are they're brilliant. They could be doing anything else, but they have decided to commit to their community, and they have a calling. Whether it's religious, spiritual, whether it's grounded in their own life background, whether we have one NGO leader who's a former young boy who was trafficked.
Wow.
And this small Catholic group helped this young boy get an education. He went on to get a university education, went to Barclays, and then decided, I have to do something for our children in Ghana. And he's working with trafficked children. His story is exactly the same story that these children is being played out.
It must be amazing for them as well to see these leadership positions being taken by people who can say, I was like you.
Absolutely. It is, you're talking the talk, right? And when you've been through that experience, that story becomes even more powerful. For me, my story has shaped why I do the Global Fund for Children in some very unique ways. I think when you see a woman who's been formerly trafficked or was a prostitute forcibly in that situation and got her life changed and is now running an NGO to save girls from this, wow.
Maya Ajmera is my guest. She is president and founder of the Global Fund for Children. She'll be speaking to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth tonight. You can find more information about that at dfwworld.org. You can learn about the Global Fund for Children at globalfundforchildren.org. You can call us now by phoning 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is president and founder of the Global Fund for Children, Maya Ajmera. She's in town to speak to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth tonight at 6 at the Rosewood Crescent Hotel. You can join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Can you talk for a minute, Maya, about your philosophy in terms of making sure that an organization is worthy of funding and is actually working? Because things can look one way on paper and present entirely sure. differently otherwise.
We're scouts. So we go out and scout for the best groups in the world. And I like to use the imagery of a high school baseball scout who sleeps at a lot of Super 8 motels and eats at a lot of Denny's restaurants to find the next Babe Ruth, perhaps. That's the way our program officers work throughout the world. When we find an organization we want to fund, one of the things we always do is we'll ask children in that community, do you know about this group? And they'll say, sometimes they'll say, yes, they're really good, we go there. Or they'll say, no, because I've heard they hit kids, so I don't go there. Hmm. So the customer base tells you the best answers, right? We end up then doing a lot of due diligence. You know, what I say, to give a $5,000 grant, the amount of due diligence we do is the same that you would do for $1 million or $2 million or $5 million. I mean, we do reference checking. We look at their other funders. We talk to community members. We have a very intense grant proposal process written in their own language because our staff speaks multiple languages. And the grant is small. So we're willing to take a small bet, see if they meet their objectives, and then the grant will get bigger. But our grant only goes up to $20,000. And at the end of the day, I like to say it's a deep empathetic trust and understanding that you look someone in the eye and you know that they're going to do very special things with your support to help children.
Yeah, what portion of your sort of rubric for evaluating these organizations is set aside for gut instinct?
Well, we have a very rigorous metrics framework. Mm-hmm. I will say that. So we measure our effectiveness in our grants that we do make. The upfront work from the proposal process to the referencing to talking to community members and children and gut instinct probably plays a good 20-25% mm-hmm. in it. Sometimes you just may see an enormous leader and their programs may be a little rocky, but you know if you invest in the leader, I think the programs will smooth themselves out because they're willing to learn and change. It's a lot different if you go in and you see a rocky leader. That doesn't work very well.
Sends up a red flag for you.
Pretty much, yeah.
It can't be easy, though, to have to say no, and you can't say yes to everybody who comes to you.
That's why we only solicit proposals. We did not want to sit back in Washington, D.C. and be an administrator where you just get piles and piles of paper and you read things. That's not dynamic to us. So we decided we would go out and look for great groups. So that cuts it down a bit. We do have a democratic process. People can go online and send in a very short online inquiry that this is what we're doing. And we can find some really good groups and do some searching through that. But it is hard to say no. I mean, the resources are tight. I mean, and we have a global economic crisis going on right now. And we did a major survey research study with all of our partners to see how the crisis was affecting them. And we heard that they're struggling from food shocks to commodity prices to grants, other funders pulling out, that we decided over the next year or two to be very, very steady with our current partners.
We have an email here from Larray who asks, can you give us an idea of the range of countries and ethnic groups that the fund works with?
Sure.
We don't want to spend the rest of the hour doing this because I know it's a long
list.
Right, right.
We're in 72 countries, mm-hmm. Range of ethnicities. We are in Latin America. We like to work in urban areas as well as rural. We also are very interested in indigenous populations. So in Guatemala, we have two groups we're working with that work with Mayan children. We work in East Asia, from China to Indonesia, Philippines, Vietnam. We work in India, throughout India, from south and north. And in Africa, we are in all parts of the continent. And if you are global, we invest in children in our own backyards. So we invest in Washington, D.C., some Native American groups. And when Hurricane Katrina ravaged New Orleans, we had a donor that called us and said, you have a methodology that works in the developing world. Can you find grassroots groups in the region? And we did. And we brought those partners and partners from who were affected from the tsunami and the Pakistani earthquake together in India to learn from each other. And they had more in common with each other than other counterparts in their own countries because of the trauma that they faced. And an NGO leader from India, from Dreamcatchers Foundation, came to New Orleans to teach NGO leaders or nonprofit leaders psychosocial therapy on how to deal with children who are afraid of water. So that sort of cross-learning is extraordinary.
Well, what's really surprising about that is that I think one would assume that from even an administrative perspective, it's difficult to be in 72 countries,
yep.
even with a multilingual staff,
yep.
because you have different cultures and
yep.
different expectations.
Yep.
But it sounds like you almost yes. find more in common than separating the groups that you work with.
Absolutely. It's the commonalities that bind us. And once you make an investment in a group and they're doing really well with that investment, that the what you end up doing is monitoring versus feeling like, is this going to work or not? So it gets easier. Your first investments over the first year are your hardest because you really want to make sure that we made the right bets. And you know, part of investing is you actually learn some lessons that don't work.
Mm-hmm.
And we've learned some good lessons about you can't invest in an organization that's too small. And you also can't leverage big amounts of money for organizations because large amounts of money, they can't absorb the resources. They have to have capacity.
Will you talk about some of the programs that exist or that are expanding today
sure.
because of the funding that your donors have given?
Sure. One of the ones I just love to talk about, just because of what's going on in Afghanistan right now, is a group called the Afghan Institute of Learning. And In 1997, I met the founder, Sakina Akubi, who was a refugee from Afghanistan but had come here. And she had gone back to Pakistan, and she had created something called the Secret Homeschools for Girls. Mm-hmm. And her budget at that time was like $30,000. And she said, Maya, I really need help to support these secret homeschools. I'm not able to get funding from UNICEF or any of these others. $5,000 will do a lot. I said, okay. So we gave $5,000 to invest in 600 girls in Kabul and Jalalabad, where she was secretly going and training teachers and mothers and how to create a secret homeschool so girls could come in and out of their homes without being caught. September 11th happened. And the day after, I called Sakina in Pakistan. I said, what can Global Fund for Children do for you now? And she said, I can't believe you're even calling. And I said, of course, this is the most important time for us to help now. And she said, I need to do something for our boys. The Taliban is falling. The boys are out on the street. They're being recruited to extreme schools. Help me create schools for boys that teach peace and tolerance and the Quran and science and mathematics. Absolutely. She grew from a $25,000 organization to a $2 million organization. She now is the largest NGO in Afghanistan, providing health care and education to 400,000 women and children. This past year, she won the Henry Kravis Prize for Development, a $250,000 prize. We stopped funding the Afghan Institute of Learning in 1995 or 96. No, in 2005, 2006, excuse me. It's one of the best investments we ever made. That's an example.
At what point do you have to say to yourself something isn't working? Have you had to sort of cut ties with certain
sure.
organizations?
Sure. There are a couple of examples where we have had, you know, you will give a group a grant, and we haven't had many of these, just maybe you can count them on one hand.
Yeah.
But one of the things we figure out is, we've learned, is internet connectivity. Sometimes we don't hear from a partner, and we get very, very concerned about what's going on. And sometimes we would drop our funding because we didn't hear. And then we would go back and do a site visit, and they're like, you don't understand. Our power goes out. Our computer goes out. And that was, you know, of course that's a realization. And so we've had to learn about how do we make communication easier for all of our partners, whether it's giving them a card for a cell phone that can communicate with us, or actually giving them money to go to an internet cafe. We have also seen absorptive capacity where we have funded a group and there can be a big funder that comes in and says, this is extraordinary, the work you're doing, we're going to help scale it and we're going to give you $1 million. And we've had to say, don't do this. And we've seen some things not go so well.
Because it went too quickly. Mm-hmm. I know that you've used the mutual fund sort of analogy mm-hmm. to help people understand. Mm-hmm. How does it work when people want to contribute money? Mm-hmm. How much control do they have over the ways their money is spent? And what do they want to know about what the organization's doing?
Well, we have some major supporters throughout the world, actually. And they can invest in our four portfolios, which is learning, health, enterprise, and safety, because we think those are the four pillars that makes a child grow up to become a productive, caring citizen of the world. They can also go by country. So we have many people who live in this country who are originally from Mexico, originally from Cambodia or India, and they will make a gift and say, we'd like our funding to be targeted to this country. So we can do that. It has to be a certain level. You know, if it's $10, it's administratively, it's a bit of a nightmare to do that. But
sure.
But if it is a significant amount, we can actually tailor it. And their expectations is, what's the success? Where did you start and where did these groups end? And what was the impact? Did the NGO get stronger? Did a number of beneficiaries, how many children did you serve? Did that get? And what were the programmatic outcomes? How many children became literate? How many children did you save from trafficking? So it's that sort of metrics that they're looking for.
Recently, we've heard a lot of coverage of the failure of certain USAID efforts, particularly in places like Afghanistan, where the money is being spent and ends up going to U.S. corporations that spend it on consultants and things like that. Where do you think is the disconnect in these well-established, well-funded, whether by government or traditional philanthropic means? Where's the disconnect between what's happening there, and some of them, of course, we know are doing very successful work, mm-hmm. and what's happening for your folks?
I think we think it's such large amounts of money. That's one thing. So if you got a pot of $100 million, that's difficult to think about in terms of how do you invest that in the grassroots. If somebody gave us $100 million and told us to invest in the grassroots, I think I have an idea of how to do that and probably do it well because we have such an extensive network and understand it. I think the field of grassroots development is still understudied, and I believe they're undervalued and undercapitalized. I mean, Nicholas Kristof in his new book basically said that Afghan Institute of Learning is probably the best investment the U.S. government could have made in Afghanistan for all the money it spent. I mean, that's an interesting, based on the money and the drainage that's happened in that country as well.
Do you think it's just a sort of a mistake of shorthand when existing organizations say, well, grassroots is too small. If they were any good, they'd be six times the size by now.
Well, we have to help them scale.
Mm-hmm.
We have to help get them give them the capacity and help them scale their work. Out of our 375 NGO partners, of the 60 that have graduated, many of them, like Afghan Institute of Learning, like the Train Platform Schools, like the Wilderness Foundation in South Africa working with AIDS orphans, they have scaled and they are continue to scale. I think we have to invest in those, but it's time. It takes time.
Do you have to help them cope with the anxiety about scaling, about the idea that maybe the culture that created this program won't survive that sort of
sure.
size change?
What does scale mean? That's the other piece of it. Does scale mean moving outward, or does it mean going deeper? And I've had many conversations with leaders about this. And I think it's per the organization and the work that they do. I think if you are working in the red light district in India or Thailand, working with sex workers and trying to get their children to have another type of life, you want to be very deep in that community because it's based on trust. And it's going to take time for change to happen. I don't think you can scale that work and franchise it out to different communities. Well, I think what Afghan Institute of Learning is doing, or trained platform schools are doing, is that you can teach the mechanisms of how you do your work to other NGO partners, or you can scale it out.
I read somewhere, if this is correct, that you also are funding some documentary work now.
We are.
Yeah. Can you talk about some of the projects and who their target audience is?
Sure. We believe that media plays a very important role in telling the story of children through our children's books, like Children from Australia to Zimbabwe or To Be a Kid, found in bookstores, or documentary photography or documentary films. And we started meeting with some very dynamic documentary film producers or filmmakers and talking about the lives of children. And we invested in one that's called War Child, and it's the story of Emmanuel Jal, who was a former child soldier in Sudan and has become a famous hip-hop singer singing about peace. He actually sung at Nelson Mandela's 90th birthday, I believe, this past year. And we were just, it's an amazing film if you can get it on Netflix.
Maya Ajmera is my guest. She's president and founder of the Global Fund for Children, in town to speak tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. We will return to our conversation in a moment, and you can either send an email to join us to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Maya Ajmera, president and founder of the Global Fund for Children. You can learn about them at globalfundforchildren.org. You can find out more about her appearance tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth at dfwworld.org. To join the conversation, give us a call, 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Ed in Arlington. Hello, Ed.
Hi. I was wondering if Ms. Ajmera could talk to me about how you affect your physically affect your transfers of money to some of these very third world countries. I don't imagine there's a Wells Fargo at the nearest shopping center where you can wire funds to be distributed in country. I'm familiar with a scenario where we had our own bag man basically on staff in Eastern Russia, and we would wire to keep the government out of dipping into the funds as much as possible. We would wire money to his personal bank account, and then he would be responsible for administering and reporting back to us the use of that money based on a budget that was developed ahead of time. Second, and related to that, I was wondering what kind of, how you want to say it, the split between direct and indirect costs or in-kind costs versus administrative costs do you expect to see your money put to use with? Certainly the people that you work with in-country are going to need to have some amount of money not spent working directly with clients. They're going to need to pay rent on an office perhaps and electricity to run a computer, maybe a car to run 200 kilometers to the nearest bank to get the money and whatnot, that kind of thing?
Thanks so much for your question or questions. Let me answer the first one. You know, we have some very serious rules that we have to follow with the Patriot Act of how money gets transferred from the United States to the developing world. And we follow those guidelines very seriously. We also, one of the issues for us is we invest in registered NGOs, non-governmental organizations. And that kind of cuts down on some of the money issues, the transfers that we're talking about. A lot of developing countries have banks throughout the world. Citibank is the global one, but then a lot of nationalized state banks. We did actually a few years ago come through to a problem where we had transferred money actually to Cambodia, to Cambodian NGOs, and we they were holding and sitting on the money. And we knew that it had reached the bank, but the bank kept telling the NGO, well, we haven't gotten it. So we've had to had some struggles there a little bit where we need to make sure that the money gets to our partner, and local banks, you know, may not sit on it. They may be earning interest or whatever the case is. The second part of your question is about overheads. For Global Fund for Children, it's a 15% overhead that we have, which is very standard in the nonprofit community, actually lower than a lot. With our NGO partners, I tend to see capacity building is really, really important. So, you know, of course, we don't want to see 50% administrative costs, but I think if our money goes to upgrading their technology systems, I think that's really, really important in terms of data collection, in terms of communication, in terms of infrastructure building. But most of these NGOs, again, are working with such scarce resources that the last thing that they're thinking about are their infrastructure needs and are working to save children's lives.
Do you sometimes have to convince them that it's
Yes.
okay to spend? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And it's sometimes very painful because I have to keep convincing, you know, we have to keep convincing them that this is important money. And they're like, but this doesn't go to the children. It must go to the children. And we say, we understand that. But if you invest in these things, you can even serve more children.
We've heard so much recently over the past couple of years about how cell phone technology is changing the developing world. And I have to imagine you're in a really good position to have observed some of this.
It's extraordinary. So Mugabe in Zimbabwe, when that country has come crashing down, our NGO partner working with AIDS orphans and children who have been affected by trafficking, the only way we could communicate with her was through cell phone. And we were trying to figure out, actually, to answer the gentleman's first question, how to get money transferred and wired. And what we ended up doing was sending like $1,000, $2,000 chunks just to make sure she could actually get the money instead of sending the full grant.
So you wouldn't lose it all if
yeah.
something happened.
Yeah, but she needed the resources to be able to do the work. And the other way we were thinking was sending it to a South African bank, her going over the border, getting the money, and then coming back across the border with the cash. You know, again, it's ingenuity. It's you know, how these organizations survive during extraordinary crises. And we work in every way possible to make that easy. Skype is another thing that's become really big with
this
those that
the
have...
The internet through... phone through the internet.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. It's become huge for our Latin American team. I mean, they've had online conferences with our NGO partners using Skype. And that means, you know, you need to have the connectivity there.
We have an email here from Tara who writes, I'm an Iranian American traveling to Iran in November. It will be the second time I've gone, the first time when I was 11. I'm now 22. Do you have any ideas for what she might do to volunteer while she's there? She says, I'm scared of possibly choosing the wrong place and creating problems for myself when leaving and trying to get back to the U.S. She does hold dual citizenship.
Unfortunately, the Global Fund for Children does not fund in Iran because of the strict guidelines of how we can fund in certain countries like Iran and Iraq. I would suggest that she goes to the Parsa Community Foundation in California. It's an Iranian American foundation that is a hub for NGOs in Iran, as well as Iranian Americans that are wanting to do service work and philanthropic work. So look up Parsa Community Foundation.
How do you organize? I know that your focus is on children, and it mm-hmm. sounds like you have a huge range of services mm-hmm. that you provide through mm-hmm. these organizations. Are there sometimes things that you say, that sounds great and it does benefit kids, but it's not quite what we want to be doing?
Yes, all the mm-hmm. time. I mean, we have, you know, these four portfolios are so broad, right?
Yeah.
So you can think about arts education as some. You can think about environmental issues as another, because you want to have kids to be safe. So you want them to have safe drinking water. We don't get into these issues of like the important work World Food Program does, providing meals. We believe World Food Program does a great job
right.
of that. We're not in the water business. So we are not helping to dig wells. If an NGO wants to dig a well for their community, we know other good partners that can help them do that. We're there to really provide the holistic services that a child needs to grow up to become a great person.
Are you able to have contact or members of your staff with the children after programs are underway
oh,
and
sure.
being funded?
That's absolutely
critical.
What's
that like? You must get letters.
I love it.
And...
Absolutely. It's the best part of the job is sitting on a dirt floor and sitting and talking to children and asking them, what are you learning? I mean, I'll never forget an amazing experience I had was the train platform schools. And I actually we started funding them, and then I did a site visit. I went with one of the kids who kept working but still going to school, and I went on the train with him. And he was a sweeper on the train cars. And then in between, he'd have like a 5-10 minute break. He'd get out his dusty, you know, ratty workbook paper and started doing his math problems. And then, you know, the conductor would come and say, what are you doing? Keep cleaning. And he'd start cleaning. And then again, he'd like take out his paper and start doing it. I mean, they were learning in their environment and going to school. And eventually, this little boy went on to formal school and stopped that type of work. But asking him what it meant, he said, I know how to write my name. Think about that. I know how to write my name. If you know how to write your name, then you learn, then you can vote someday, right? I mean, everything happens after you learn how to read and write.
I imagine all those experiences have to put an American childhood into a really different perspective, even one that allowed you the opportunities to travel in other places and experience other cultures.
Oh, I grew up very middle class. I grew up with privilege. and I'm very, very lucky that my public school in Eastern North Carolina was a poor public school, but I still had extraordinarily caring teachers. I had infrastructure. I had clean water. I had a toilet to go to, you know, a bathroom to go to. And I was taught how to read and loved books. I thank my teachers for who I am today. If I've had that experience at a very basic level, then I think every child should. I think we're very lucky in this country.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we'll speak with TJ in Plano. Hey, TJ.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, how are you guys? I really appreciate what these guys do, especially in the third world countries. My question was, they did mention Zimbabwe in particular, and how they had to use cell phones once upon a time just to communicate and do their job. I wonder now that they have a unity government, has the environment changed? Is it more favorable to allow these guys to do their jobs a little better? I want to know if she can address that. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Actually, I would say yes, things have gotten better. You know, we've been able to transfer some funds, and they've gotten through, and they've been able to receive them. And there has been some email connectivity as well, as from what I understand from our program officers.
What do you want people to understand who have a limited pot of money in their own budget for doing good work? The sort of new thinking is that you choose one thing or a small handful of things and then really focus.
Mm-hmm.
But people might hear about this and think, well, you know, how do I incorporate that?
Well, one of the things I always, people feel so overwhelmed by the problems in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, if you saw the news, headline news today, there's 1 billion people in the world right now who are hungry. That's overwhelming. And I think one of the things about the Global Fund for Children, it doesn't feel overwhelming. It actually feels like, wow, there are 375 partners that you can affect the lives of children at a very local level that's very targeted. If you go onto our website, you can actually see the groups that we invest in. These are not invisible. They're not invisible. I think a lot of groups are very, you know, they give a lot of the big statistics and they say they're doing the work, but where does it go? Where does it end up going? And for us, every single one of those dollars are accounted for by the organizations that receive them. And that feels that's connectivity to us and friendship.
Is there anything unique about your metrics for measuring success that you have sort of incorporated after doing this for a while?
Sure.
And thought we really need to put a line item in to account for this?
Well, one of the things we've developed on our metrics framework is something called an organizational capacity building tool. So we actually look at it, we want to get an organization at its nascent or emerging stage, and we want to get them to the strengthening or thriving stage. Mm. And to be able to evaluate, we have 7 indicators: fundraising, planning, board, human resources, programmatic effectiveness, and we'll rate them from 1 to 5. And our organization will rate themselves, we'll rate them, and we'll see how they're rated. And wherever they're low, that gives GFC the clue, what are some of the other extra things we can do for them so they can get stronger? Because there's a strong correlation that if your infrastructure and your organization gets strong, your program effectiveness goes up and you're able to reach more children. And that's been a really interesting tool that a lot of funders are quite excited about. And we want to actually hopefully put that online at some point, that it can be a tool that anybody can use.
Anything on the horizon that you're sort of just about to start funding that you're really excited about?
Well, I'd like to say the things that keep me up at night.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you 2 things that are keeping me up at night. I am a big fan of Nicholas Kristof and the book he's just written about women and the investment in girls. And the best investment we can make is in girls. But I'm also very, very concerned about the plight of boys globally. And I think in many countries, you're seeing more boys on the street. There are more boys than girls in the population. What does that mean for civil society? And so I'm very, very concerned. And this came from Sakina Kubi of Afghan Institute of Learning, who was saying, I have boys on the street who are being recruited to extreme schools. I need to help them.
So we can't forget.
We cannot forget. And we're about girls and boys.
Maya Ajmera is founder and president of the Global Fund for Children. She will address the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth tonight at 6. Learn more about that at DFW World. You can learn about the Global Fund for Children at globalfundforchildren.org. Maya, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.